Welcome to Alameda Community Radio's News and Views. I'm your host, Susan Galley-Moore, and I'll be with you for this view into the workings and goings-on in our city of Alameda. Paul Kaibel is Professor of Environmental and Natural Resources at Golden Gate University School of Law in San Francisco. Kaibel is interested in Alameda Point in his capacity as co-director of the Law School Center on Urban Environmental Law, and we pronounce that
CUEL.
I keep wanting to say cool. CUEL has undertaken independent research and analysis on land use and open space issues pertaining to Alameda Point, including the publication in 2011 of a color brochure outlining open space, habitat, and parkland opportunities at the former naval station. Now, I'm going to put a copy of that brochure up on the website, and listeners can download it from the News and Views page of ACR's website, which is alamedacommunityradio.org. It's a really nice brochure, and I want people to appreciate the work that you've put into it. Paul Kaibel participated in the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is the IUCN, at the annual Academy of Law Colloquium. IUCN is the largest network of environmental organizations in the world, and it's attended by hundreds of environmental lawyers, professors, policymakers, and regulators from more than 30 countries. At this IUCN, Paul Kaibel spoke on fragmented open space, emphasizing issues specifically regarding the Navy's draft plan for Site 2 at Alameda Point. And listeners know at this point that Site 2 is the former dump site, or the former burn site, and it's one of the most toxic parts of the former base. It's currently undergoing remediation for a range of toxic chemicals, from TCE, I think, is the most important chemical out there, but there's a whole alphabet soup of chemicals. So we're going to talk to Paul Kaibel on Site 2 and other issues associated with reusing the base. Welcome, Paul Kaibel.
Thank you.
I want to spend some of our time today on the anticipated build of the Veterans Administration, too, but let's start with a snapshot of your thinking. What is your project doing and what is it not doing?
The project we have at the Center for Urban Environmental Law, CUEL, is part of our Urban Green Space project. So our particular focus is on issues at Alameda Point that relate to open space, which also includes parkland and habitat for us. We have not been taking the issue of toxic cleanup or remediation as sort of the centerpiece of our project, but as it relates to Site 2, and we can talk about this some more, the issues of what is happening with the cleanup are very much interrelated with the long-term plans for the site for open space and as a wildlife refuge. So that's sort of what we're doing, our sort of thinking. Our funding, I can disclose this in the spirit of Citizens United, comes some from the university and from several local and regional private foundations who were interested in supporting the work that we did. And the work that we did was undertaken in collaboration with a professor at UCLA's Department of Landscape Architecture, Stephanie Landegren, who's been an urban park planner for a long time. But what we really wanted to do was, accepting that there's two parts to Alameda Point, there's a part that's under the city's jurisdiction where most of the buildings are, and there's a planning process there, and then there's the federal portions where the tarmac and Site 2 are. It seemed like these two land use processes were happening with no awareness of each other, and that we thought that there were real opportunities, if they were integrated, to create better land use results, better open space results. So we took upon it ourselves to kind of articulate an open space vision for Alameda Point that intentionally ignored the jurisdictional boundaries of the city and the federal portion and said, let's just think about how beautiful and how magnificent and ecologically rich this site could be, and then let's figure out how to do it.
A holistic approach. My, that's somewhat kind of original. So you approached the city. How did that go?
It's ongoing. Our initial entry point was to develop the material, the brochure that you have there, which is called Flight Park at Alameda Point.
A copy of the color brochure published by CUEL called Flight Path at Alameda Point is on News and Views show page at alamedacommunityradio.org. Go to the website, you'll see shows, drop down to News and Views, and you will find both the document and a copy of this show. You'll find other documents pertaining to this topic there too. Now let's return to Paul Kaibel, Professor of Environmental and Natural Resources Law at Golden Gate University School of Law in San Francisco.
Flight Park became sort of shorthand for our way of saying, let's think beyond jurisdictional boundaries and approach it that way. Our first dialogue with the city was really related to the city's land use process, their going forward process, and they were looking at different land use scenarios, and we were particularly interested in some of the land use scenarios around Seaplane Lagoon and the opportunity to not push development right up to the edge of the lagoon, but perhaps to set it back more like Crissy Field, less like Jack London Square, that we thought that would make some sense and would create habitat corridors with the federal portion. So we began a dialogue with them about that. The way I would describe it is they were polite but noncommittal, but we have remained engaged with them. The second interaction with the city has been to get the city to take an interest in what's going on the federal portion. I think they've tended to have a view that it's out of their control and they can't do anything about it. And we've suggested otherwise, that if the city defines and articulates what it wants out on the federal portion and is a vigorous advocate for that, that may well affect what happens out there. And I would say we've been disappointed in that area. I think they still are not very engaged with the Site 2 situation. We'll talk about this perhaps a little movement, but baby steps, I would say, which is unfortunate because I think the city has the spine and the vision, could play a really meaningful role in shaping what happens out there on the federal portions, and it's not.
There's been a lot of talk about what's going to happen with Site 1 and Site 2. Both of those sites, again, are probably the more toxic, not the most, but probably more toxic than the others. And they're right up against the water, mm-hmm. right on the bay, and there's riprap there. The Navy was talking about it being a Tidelands Trust or so forth. So there was a push towards having it open. But most recently, the Navy handed out a document that implied totally, and in fact, they've already set up a fence with these very tall pipes to expel methane, even though they're saying at this point there's not a lot of methane. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that?
I can. So the Navy has been moving towards getting approval for what's called a permanent set of remedies out there. And the agencies that need to approve the permanent remedies are the base closure team, which consists of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Regional Water Board, which is a state agency, and the Department of Toxic Substances Control, DTSC. Collectively, they refer to themselves as the Base Closure Team, BCT. So at the end of May, the Navy and its consultants submitted a remedial action work plan with a set of permanent remedies for Site 2. And two of the remedies, which would be permanent, that they proposed were putting a exclusionary fence around 110 acres. It would be a 6-foot-high chain-link fence with barbed wire, and maintaining a series of about 30 methane gas vents, which are about 10 feet high. While at the same time, in the same document, they recognize that everyone agrees that the long-term use of this space is for open space and possibly even a wildlife refuge. So CUEL and other stakeholders have been raising the issue of how is an exclusionary fence possibly consistent with open space? In fact, it excludes people from it, and have been pressing the Navy and the BCT regulators to look at other long-term solutions for the site that, one, would not involve the exclusionary fence, the chain-link barbed wire fence, and that, two, would we recognize there are methane issues out there, but there appear to be a host of other remedies available. They would just cost more for the Navy that would limit the number of vents and limit their height. And our sense so far is that we've had some traction. And how I gauge that is by the letters that came out from USCPA and that came out from the Regional Water Board, which both on the comments on the Navy's plan basically told them that they needed to go back and explore alternatives to the fencing and the gas vent network in light of the long-term open space plan. So we don't know how it's going to play out, but we feel at least we've forced forced a real conversation about it. So that's kind of where it's at right now.
Would it help for Alameda residents to comment or send? Who can they comment to? And
yes, the short answer is yes, it absolutely would help. And the fact that so many citizens and groups weighed in, I think, played a big role in the positions that the Navy, not the Navy, but that the Regional Water Board and USEPA took, and additionally, the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. For groups or citizens that are concerned about this, I would direct their comments first to the Navy, but it's very important that those comments be CC'd and also directed to the other regulatory agencies involved. In particular, I would call out the Regional Water Board, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. They're all going to be very involved. And we're not certain always whether the Navy is relaying all the public comments in a timely manner to those other agencies, so we're making sure that happens.
I'll interrupt Paul Kaibel for a moment to say that you can find a list of names and contact info on our News and Views show page on the website alamedacommunityradio.org. Contact these folks as well as your city council people, whose names are on the City of Alameda website. Before we return to Paul Kaibel, a reminder that you're listening to Alameda Community Radio's News and Views. I'm Susan Gallimore, and this show, News and Views, brings you in-depth views and news on issues concerning the City of Alameda. Alameda Community Radio is, for now, an internet radio, and we're just beginning streaming, so you can listen also online to the stream, and that means it sounds like it's live. Do a Google search on Alameda Radio Stream for that URL and listen at your convenience. Our website, alamedacommunityradio.org, also has more information on our streaming capacities. ACR will apply for a low-power FM license when the FCC opens up its application window early next year. Then ACR will build the technical and engineering capacity to broadcast across the island on traditional radio. And that's going to be a lot of fun and make a lot of difference, I think, to how information is disseminated across the island. So get in on the ground floor and help build community radio in our town. We need folks to commit to producing local shows, music, whatever it is that you'd like to do. Go to the website and you'll find out more about how to propose a show. And we also encourage you to volunteer in whatever capacities you can. And more importantly, if you can become a founding member, imagine being a founding member of Alameda Community Radio. And years back, you can think to yourself how proud you are that you were able to donate some funding to and became a founding member on the ground floor of the build of a local community station. So we need founding members. We also need financial sponsors. And we plan on bringing you presentations about many of the topics involving our town. Indeed, I'm working on bringing Paul Kaibel, who you're listening to today, to speak on the topics he addresses in this show. This will be in early August, and you can actually meet Paul Kaibel in person, hear what he has to say, ask him any questions you have in the area of his expertise that he's covered here. Visit our website at alamedacommunityradio.org for details as they become available. We just decided on this today, so a lot of work to do, and if you want to get involved in that and helping produce that, find a venue and so forth, get in touch with me at alamedacommunityradio@gmail.com. alamedacommunityradio@gmail.com. It would be great to have your help. Meanwhile, share the show with your family, friends, and neighbors by sending them the web link to the show. Again, alamedacommunityradio.org. Go to the show page, look for News and Views, and you will find the URL and email that to your friends and family. Now, back to Paul Kaibel, Professor of Environmental and Natural Resources Law at the Golden Gate University School of Law in San Francisco. Kaibel is also co-director of the Law School Center on Urban Environmental Law, and that website is GGUCUEL. So Golden Gate University, CUEL, GGUCUEL.org. I'm Susan Gallimore with News and Views, bringing you in-depth views on news and issues concerning our city in Alameda. When I talk to the city officials, and again, I've been going to these restoration advisory board meetings probably now for about 6 years, so I know a fair amount about what's going on out there. And when I talk to city officials about it, they harp on maybe that's not the best use of word. They emphasize the cost. They say, well, you know, the Navy has already spent $500 million out there, and the implication is, why should they spend any more? What do you think?
I think they should spend what they need to deal with the environmental problems they created. I don't think anyone at this point is suggesting a complete dig out and removal of the dump site area. That would be, you know, north of $700 million, and that's cost prohibitive. But the things we're talking about are not. So, for instance, the reason I think they wanted the perimeter fencing, as I understand it, did not have to do with human health hazards. They had some theory that they had some monitoring equipment out there, and they didn't want people to disturb the soils or touch the equipment. We did research showing that at similar sites that have been similar landfill sites that are now parks and open space, they've been operating for 10 years. No one has tried to dig through the fill to get to it. No one has tampered with the equipment. And they could put really small, discreet little fencing around the units rather than keeping the area. So I think what this is really about is this is the cheapest and the easiest route. Another example, there's a culvert out there, an underground culvert which provides tidal flow between wetlands in Site 2 and the bay. And it's in very poor condition, and the Navy has not really been volunteering to help replace it. A recent proposal has been put forth by a member of the RAB, Richard Banger, a brilliant proposal, which is, let's just daylight this culvert. Let's take out the culvert, let's make a cut, and have a daylighted area where we can have natural tidal flow. Would that cost some money to dig out the dirt in that area? Sure, but not a tremendous amount. Would they probably have to put some sort of bridge to make it over the walkway? Sure, but I've done those with old rail cars, so it costs about $40,000. The Navy can pay $40,000 for a rail car bridge. There are solutions out there that may require a little bit of time and thought to get through, but I don't think they're cost prohibitive in any way. I think it's more about time than money right now for the Navy, and I think this might be where you're going with the VA. They want this done, and I think they want it done now, not because of the cost, because they want to be able to give the property to the Veterans Administration in the next couple months. And I think that's actually what's really going on. That's the backstory. It's not money, yeah. It's time.
There's several different backstories going on here. One is that the Restoration Advisory Board has been a monthly meeting for some time, well, ever since it started, and I think 1997. And suddenly, last year, they decided to put it to every 2 months, which means that we can't really keep track. It was already too much documentation, and now we still really can't keep track of the kind of documentation that's coming out. So there's a push there. There's also they just cleaned out Seaplane Lagoon. It was full of PCBs and radium and so forth. And so they decided, they did an enormous amount of work cleaning it out. Well, not cleaning it out, but
dredging it,
and then deciding what soil needed to be taken to a hazardous dump and what soil could be used to hover an institutional control out at Site 2. And yet they're still talking about putting this fence up. So, you know, the money issue doesn't really make a lot of sense.
No, I mean, I think it would make, if people were insisting on the dig out, the $700 million dig out, yes. But I don't think it's what's going on. It's about trying to fast track getting the cleanup remedies approved so that they can, because that's an important piece for the Navy of being able to have that resolved, to be able to transfer the property to the VA. So the more they have to go back and look at, oh, do we have to dig out a culvert? Do we have to daylight it? Do we have to put in a bridge? Do we have to look at alternatives? They've got a schedule they're trying to keep, and this is not what they want for their schedule. But one thing I should add, I mean, this goes to the issue of, I think among some people there's concerns about whether the Navy is being forthright about a lot of things that are going on out there. When the Navy presented its permanent remedies to the RAB, I guess they did about a 30-40 minute presentation. You were probably there, I wasn't. My understanding is they actually made no mention of the fence in their presentation at all. The only reason this was discovered was because a very diligent RAB member, Richard Banger, during and after the meeting was flipping through the Navy's materials, and on something like page 27 was where they had the information, oh, by the way, we're going to put up a permanent chain link exclusionary fence around this area for open space. But for his diligence in finding that piece of information buried in there, the Navy didn't even mention it in its presentation. And I think I can understand why people are disturbed and concerned about that.
Yeah, I don't want to knock the Navy here if they support themselves. But yeah. I also want to add...
I'm just saying it's important.
But this happens a lot, actually, okay. In the Navy. I mean, they give us these 1,000-page documents, and they give us a month to comment on them. And there's only one up there, you know, one at the up there being the depository, the book mm-hmm. depository. So there's a lot of pushing that, you know, people resist after a while. So I want to also mention that right now the city of Alameda has decided that Measure A perhaps needs to be overturned. And I think it has something to do with the Navy, the former Naval Base, too, because we have to apparently come up with 1,000 housing units. And I think if they turn that over fast enough, they can tell ABAG, the governmental Bay Area governmental group, that they've done the work and that they've got all of these things. So that's probably also a pressure. I'm going to do more radio on that mm-hmm. in the future, but I want now to talk about the VA. It started off being, let's have a columbarium. Mm-hmm. And now?
Well, I mean, the columbarium was sort of a memorial ground for soldiers that had died in action. So there had been long-term discussions with the VA about siting some sort of columbarium out, usually out either on the federal portions of the site, or then there was some discussion of an area known as the Northwest Territories, which is in the open space areas, but it's on the very northern end of the open space areas. And for a number of years, the assumption has been that the Navy was going to turn that over to the city, but to be managed as open space. But in more recent years, there's been discussion of siting not only the columbarium, but an outpatient facility, which would provide medical services to veterans out somewhere at Alameda Point. And, you know, right now, the current proposals that are under discussion are to site the columbarium and the VA outpatient facility adjacent to each other, either on the federal portions, or now they're talking more about siting it in this area of the Northwest Territories.
Yes, it's along the estuary.
Close. Yes, right. But a little bit north of there. So, that's what the proposal is, and the Navy and the VA are interested in kind of fast tracking this transfer and approval process. And there's a number of things underway with that I can talk about. Where CUEL comes in is, you know, for a number of years we've been trying to articulate a vision of Alameda Point that maximizes open space and habitat benefits. And for us, the flip side of that is avoiding fragmentation of land, of habitat, of view sheds. And the siting of the VA outpatient facility in the open expanses of Alameda Point really is at cross purposes with that. It's at cross purposes in terms of view sheds and habitat. Our bigger concern is that there is going to be a road cutting through the open space expanses to get out to the VA facility. And by the Navy's own documents, they are estimating about 350 employees out there, about 500 to 600 daily visits out there to the outpatient facility, about 50 to 75 visits to the columbarium with little or no probably food services, which means everyone who's working out there is going to have to probably get in a car and drive somewhere to lunch. So from our discussions with traffic engineers, we're going to be looking at upwards of 1,500 vehicular trips a day out in this area that we're talking about is open space and wildlife habitat. So to me, we're basically creating like 880. Creating
this is
a freeway.
Also going through the tube. The Webster
tubes. I understand. There are concerns about the traffic that are related to congestion coming into Alameda through the tube and through the streets, and those are valid. We have not looked at those as much just because our focus is on open space, but we're just looking at that area. If you know sort of where Hangar 1 is, think of where Hangar 1 is and going out to where the VA facility is there, and imagine 1,500 to 2,000 car trips a day. That's about 250 cars an hour. I mean, you just reverse engineer the volume of traffic in terms of disruption, in terms of noise, in terms of exhaust, in terms of potentially birds and waterfowl being killed on the road is enormous. So with that concern, we've taken that in a couple directions. One is we've made some suggestions for alternative locations at Alameda Point where the VA might be able to site its outpatient facility. The columbarium is probably fine out there. And the wonderful news, as we view it, is that in light of what happened with the Berkeley Lab situation where Alameda was passed over, the Berkeley lab site had been set aside for a large institutional facility, is now available. And there's so many sound reasons to look about relocating the VA facility to the Berkeley lab site, but the train is so far down the tracks, it's hard to get them to look at it. The other thing that we're focusing on, and this is maybe more in our capacity as lawyers, is there are two processes going on right now. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is preparing a biological opinion about the VA facility.
And in that area. Northern Territories.
And similarly, in the next couple months, the VA is going to be preparing a environmental assessment, is what it's called, under a law called the National Environmental Policy Act about the VA facility. We now know, as of last week, that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's biological opinion, its BIOP, included zero analysis whatsoever of vehicular usage on the road. It just simply didn't include it. So we've been in a rather terse dialogue with the Fish and Wildlife Service saying, listen, you know, at a minimum, you know, this is clearly a part of the project. The people aren't going to materialize. 350 employees and 600 visitors aren't going, like, via Star Trek to just show up at the facility. They're going to drive there. So the road and the vehicles on the road are part of the project. You need to do an assessment of their impacts. I don't know what they are. I'm not a wildlife biologist. So we're dealing with Fish and Wildlife about that. And then I think in the coming months, what we're going to be dealing with is, I think indications are that the Navy is inclined to try to adopt a document called a Finding of No Significant Impact, a FONSI, for the VA facility, which would mean it does not have to do an environmental impact report. And we are concerned about that. We think a full environmental impact statement needs to be done to really look at the impacts, to look at opportunities for mitigation, to explore whether there are viable alternative sites. And we have some concerns that the VA's the access road and the vehicle usage might also be excluded from this document called a FONSI. But, you know, front and center right now is the Fish and Wildlife Service appears to be on the brink of issuing this. And our view, if it's as they've described it, is that it would be legally deficient under the Endangered Species Act, and we're trying to get them to take a step back. But once again, this is all about the schedule. I'm not blaming Fish and Wildlife, but they're getting, I believe, a lot of pressure from the Veterans Administration and the Navy to get this biop done and get it done soon. So if they go back and do it right, it's going to cause delays. And it's the same thing that's going on with Site 2. We're starting to see what's going on.
I actually talked to a couple of people at the Fish and Wildlife. I talked to the external affairs person who's promised that he's going to put me in touch with talking to some of the actual people that he says he can't speak in depth to any of these things. What I asked him was, who gave you the information about it? You know, and it sounds like he said, well, the Navy, the city, and some of the state regulators. And so I think the issue might be there, insufficient information going into this thing. But once it's out there, I understand it's very difficult to pull a biological opinion back.
Well, let's put it this way. I think the recourse, and there is lots and lots of litigation under the Endangered Species Act, but if you believe an agency has issued a inadequate biological opinion, ultimately the recourse is to sue the Fish and Wildlife Service. There was a lot of litigation in California around the Bay Delta and water supply and salmon and steelhead, in which Fish and Wildlife and it has sort of a sister agency, the National Marine Fisheries Service, issued biological opinions saying the operation of the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project was not having an adverse impact on listed species. And they were sued by a bunch of environmental fishery groups, and they lost, and they threw out the biop. So there's a long history of this happening. But I do agree with you, and this is consistent. I think what happened is exactly what you described. I don't think this is the Fish and Wildlife Service trying to shirk its responsibilities. I think they received information from the VA about the VA's proposal, and the VA, kind of like burying the fence stuff on page 27, made some references that there'll be some road, but didn't really indicate that this road doesn't exist now. There's no baseline traffic. It didn't indicate the increase in vehicular usage. So as a consequence, I think Fish and Wildlife Service missed it. Mm-hmm. They missed it because it wasn't really called out as part of the project. And if I had to assign culpability, I think it's really more about the VA giving a incomplete description of really what the project is to Fish and Wildlife Service than the Fish and Wildlife Service trying to avoid doing a proper analysis. I would imagine Fish and Wildlife Service is actually quite, no one's inviting me to these meetings, but I would imagine they're probably quite upset right now at the VA for putting them in this late in the day position and not calling this out. And I think I have some empathy for the Fish and Wildlife Service. But at the end of the day,
it's an important document.
Well, I'll put that empathy aside because they have an obligation, the Fish and Wildlife Service, to comply with the Endangered Species Act and do a proper assessment of the project. And the road and the vehicular use on the road are clearly part of the project. So they can have a blame session about how they got here, but at the end of the day, I think what they need to do is go back and do a proper biological opinion.
And there's also, this may or may not have anything to do with it, but the Fish and Wildlife Service and the City of Alameda have had a couple of run-ins recently with the City of Alameda wanting Fish and Wildlife to pay, $6 million for land that they're getting for free?
A slight variation on that. There's another agency involved, which is the East Bay Regional Parks District. East Bay Regional Park District, they manage about 100,000 acres of parkland throughout the bay. And there was some discussion on that Northwest Territories area. The city doesn't really have the resources or, frankly, the expertise to know how to manage wetlands and natural resources. They can run a city park, but this is way out of their league. This is what East Bay Regional Parks has great expertise in this. So East Bay Regional Parks said, listen, tell you what, we will agree to manage the land for you, the Northwest Territories for you, which seemed like a win-win situation. Then the city doesn't have to, you know, beef up its parks department to do it. But as part of this deal, even though the city was getting the land for free from the Navy, the city insisted that the East Bay Regional Park District pay the city of Alameda $6 million so that the East Bay Regional Park District could manage the land. And they wanted them to use bond money to do it. And the East Bay Regional Park District said no. They said no because it's actually an illegal use of the bond money. But more importantly, they said, you're getting the land for free. And we're agreeing to manage it for free. And you want us to pay you to do that? So, and I think actually Fish and Wildlife Service was aligned with the park district. They thought this was a good idea. This is a very competent agency that knows natural resources and wetlands and can do this. We didn't weigh in on this too much right now, other than we sent a letter a couple months back. We didn't actually know about the insistence on the $6 million. We learned about that later, but we said, this sounds like a great idea. We said, maybe the East Bay Regional Park District should manage the federal portions too, because then they could manage it as one parkland.
Mm-hmm.
We said
again.
Holistically, right, you know, across jurisdiction lines. So we were very supportive of that. I know the Sierra Club sent a letter a couple weeks ago basically supporting the park district, and they sent a letter to the city saying, not only is this inappropriate to demand payment, but it's not even a permissible use of bond money to do that. So I think the city is appears to be shooting itself in the foot or the face, or I'm not sure what the metaphor is.
It's also a part of their financial stress. They're having an enormous amount of financial stress now. So they're trying perhaps to come up with money, but they're trying in this case certainly in the wrong way.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Yeah. Also, I live near Crab Cove, and there's a little spot here called Neptune Point. Mm-hmm. The East Bay Regional Park District tried to buy that when the city decided to auction it off. And the city refused. They sold it to, they allowed a developer to take it. Now, there's a whole bunch of other, you know, integrated, sort of tangled pieces of the web here, but whether it's been zoned properly or whatnot. But it's another indication of, you know, a financial stress that may come back and shoot us in the foot 20 years down the line when we're looking at our island and saying, if only we had kept it greener.
Yeah. I think the situation with Neptune Point is probably, you know, it gives us some context. There's a longer history here. But what seems particularly odd is the city itself has acknowledged that the majority of the land out there at Alameda Point, for a variety of reasons, because it would liquefy during an earthquake and it's fill and it's public trust land, is not appropriate for development. So they're not even talking about to the park district about, you know, save this as parkland or we'll develop it. this was land that they had always envisioned would be managed as parks and open space. And East Bay Regional Park District is offering to take the management costs off their plate, which seems like I would shake their hand and say thank you very much, rather than trying to extract the $6 million. So it was funny. I spoke with the city and they said, this is maybe government speak, but they said, well, East Bay Regional Park District isn't interested in the land.
Hmm.
That's a half truth.
Mm-hmm.
They're not interested in the land because the city is insisting that they pay $6 million for it. So
we're talking to Paul Kaibel, Golden Gate University School of Law in San Francisco, and also co-director of the Law School Center on Urban Environmental Law. When we were talking in preparation for this conversation today, you mentioned something called mitigation banks.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we can change track a little and have you describe to our listeners what a mitigation bank is and how it might help with not just Alameda, but the kind of Bay Area that surrounds us.
Sure. And we've discussed this already with some of the city Alameda staff, particular John Russo, Jennifer Ott, and Andrew Thomas. But the basic idea with a mitigation bank, or sometimes they're called conservation banks, is that you have entities that are doing things that are causing adverse impacts on natural resources, often wetlands or marshes. But the entities doing these really want to go forward with the projects, despite the fact that they're having adverse impacts on wetlands. Wetlands mitigation banks were set up as a device to allow a particular project to go forward, but they then required the person undertaking the project to either directly implement or fund other projects with similar wetlands in the same area to enhance or expand them to offset the damage that they were doing. And that's the basic idea. You know, there's a number of areas of Alameda Point, particularly on the federal portions, where there's extensive wetlands network that need a lot of work, including maybe what I just described, like with this culvert situation. But there's a lot of work that could be done to enhance and expand and improve the wetlands. And what I had suggested and what Kuehl had suggested was that if the city and the federal agencies and the park district and the Fish and Wildlife got together collaboratively and created a wetlands bank out for Alameda Point, they could then begin collecting money from other people in the Bay Area for our mitigation projects. And in particular, why this came to mind, and one, just so you know, I'm not making this up, there's about 25 or 30 conservation or wetlands banks operating in California. This has been going on for decades. So this is I didn't come up with this. I don't want to take credit for it. But the Port of Oakland, which operates extensive facilities through the airport and its maritime facilities along the water, has had a lot of problems with adverse impacts on open space along the waterfront. And they have been actively looking. They put out a request for proposals for someone to come to them with wetlands mitigation projects for all the problems they're having. And the Port of Oakland has resources. So what Kuehl suggested, and at least John Russo thought this was a good idea, was, you know, how are we going to, Paul, this is a nice idea Kuehl has, how are we going to get the money to do this? And what I said, you know, there's two things here. One is the East Bay Regional Park District is interested. If you guys can get your act together and invite them on fair terms, they'll manage it for you. And secondly, go take the Port of Oakland's money. Set up a mitigation bank and tell them to park it in your park and start collecting money for these projects. But I said, you guys have to start working together and come up with real plans to do that. So they're not institutionally ready, but I thought it was a very straightforward funding mechanism. And what I can say is Kuehl actually offered its services. We have a lot of lawyers and resources available. We said we would work with the city and the other agencies to help create it. But no one has taken us up on that offer.
It sounds like carbon credits or carbon offsets, right?
Yes, which, hopefully less illusory, though.
Yeah, which is somewhat controversial in other parts of the world, too, and maybe we can talk about that at some other point.
These are controversial, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the devil, I think, like with any mitigation program, is in the details in terms of enforcement and how you really quantify the mitigation. And so I'm not saying there's not thorny issues, but...
But you're saying there's potential to work things out in a way that is
fair.
Well,
what's different is that the Port of Oakland has already done this damage. this is less for projects they want to do. It's more that they owe mitigation already under existing projects, and they're trying to find projects to do. So to me, in that situation, if we come up with a series of well-defined mitigation projects and an ability, wetlands mitigation projects, and a structure that we can take their checks to do it, that's a good outcome. It would have to be closely monitored and watchdog, all that, but I'm just saying conceptually.
It would also heal the rift with the East Bay Regional Parks and the city on this silly demand of $6 million. So we were talking to Paul Kaibel, and we are going to continue conversations with you in the future for our radio show, because I think this is extremely helpful for people in the city to understand. But I want to also make sure that you have offered all of the information that you think is appropriate for this particular conversation. Is there anything that we've left off that you would like people to know?
The only thing I might add, and I know this ends on a more abstract than tangible note, but the document that you're going to post is called Flight Park at Alameda Point. And I guess what I wanted to explain a little bit is the idea for Flight Park, the name, came from the fact that, one, there's this long and distinguished military history at the site in terms of the jet fighters, and it was a way to honor that. It was a way to acknowledge the California lease tern and other waterfowl that are out there in terms of taking flight. But I think we also wanted, you know, the idea of imagination taking flight was definitely part of the thought behind the name, and to get people to think beyond the jurisdictional boundaries about the magnificent potential of this site. That was really front and center for us. And, you know, if, to the extent we've helped contribute to that thinking, that's good.
And again, I'll post that on the website, alamedacommunityradio.org. Is there any way that people can get in touch with you?
Sure. I can give that information now. But the best way is if you go to our website at the Center for Urban Environmental Law. There's email contact information for myself and the other co-director, Professor Alan Ramo. There's more information about the Urban Green Space Project at Alameda Point and all other contact information for me. And I think that's this www.gguqul.org.
And the other thing that I noticed was on that website that you just mentioned, there's lots and lots and lots of really pertinent documents on brownfields and all kinds of interesting stuff that if anybody is really interested, they will find fascinating. So thank you so much for being with us. And this is the first, I hope, of many conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Paul Kaibel, Professor of Environmental and Natural Resources Law at Golden Gate University School of Law in San Francisco, also co-director of the Law School Center on Urban Environmental Law. The website there is gguecul.org. That's Golden Gate University, QL, gguecul.org. ACR has plans afoot to bring Paul Kaibel to Alameda to talk about the topics he addresses in this show. That will be in early August, and you can meet Paul Kaibel, hear in person what he has to say, and ask him any questions you have in the area of his expertise. Visit the website alamedacommunityradio.org for details as they become available, and tell your friends and colleagues. The more people we have there, the more chance we have of disseminating good factual information across the island. Email me, Susan Gallimore, at alamedacommunityradio@gmail.com, and get on our subscriber list too. Meanwhile, get involved with a radio in Alameda. ACR's tagline is Our City, Our Voices, Our Media, and that's the intention of ACR, to create a community resource where we bring you the voices and views that affect our city in media you can afford. Right now, ACR is internet radio, although we are in collaboration with Ninth Floor Radio at the Peralta Community College District. And we're getting technical and equipment help, as well as sharing talent with Ninth Floor Radio. That's ninthfloorradio.org. Visit the website, alamedacommunityradio.org, to listen to any of our shows. We're getting more and more nowadays. And again, join me, Susan Gallimore, on News and Views soon, and email me at alamedacommunityradio@gmail.com. Thank you.